Hello, you're listening to The Joys of Teaching Literature. We're here talking about all things high school English, and getting kids to really immerse themselves in literature and novels, short stories, essays, anything that's got letters and words and phrases and sentences and chapters and all those different things, stanzas, let's throw those in there. If you want to know more about me, I have online professional development courses for high school English teachers. I'm not sure if I mentioned this, actually. I paired up with coursesforteachers.net and college in California. I should really know the name of it. It's the University of the Pacific. That's it. I knew I had it somewhere in my brain. It's been a long day. And you can now take my online courses and get university credit for those courses. And if you take both of my courses, the one for high school English teachers, and then I have another sort of one where there's a little bit of crossover, but it's also just different things about how to teach, activities, running activities, different things like that. I use a lot, obviously, my life as an English teacher as examples in all of those strategies, but you can take both courses and get three actual college credits. It's like a equivalent to a semester class in college, which it's funny. I don't know why I ran across how much the last college level course that I took at Rutgers, I came across, it cost around, I think it was $2,500. And that was a while ago, and that's in-state tuition. You can pay, I think it's like $100 a credit plus the whatever it costs my course. So it's, on the surface, it's like, oh, that's a lot of money. But when you compare it to an actual college course, and then if you're looking for master's plus 30 and trying to advance in the salary guide, most states will, there's different state to state's different with what kind of credit that they accept. I think it's usually district level or state level. Where they obviously have to, have prior approval for your professional development credit hours. But this, again, if you're trying to advance in the salary with credits, you can take them at any college. And so that's a cool new benefit to taking my online course. It's officially like it's officially a college course and get you three credits. I think the one for English teachers is two credits. So that's cool. That's cool. Exciting news. The part of the reason I started professional development was to talk about this kind of topic. And I remember going to the convention, National Council of Teach English Convention, when I was a young teacher, and I think it was just like classroom management strategies or discussion strategies. I can't remember the topic. But I remember not really finding a good answer to a question that I had, was that, at least at the time I was teaching, sophomores and seniors. And at the time, we don't have tracking at my school. Let me just say, the topic is whole class discussion strategies. So that was my kind of question, is with discussion, whole class discussion, we're getting sort of all the kids in your class to talk and to be a part of the conversation. In my school, we don't have tracking, at least up until junior year, if you can argue, AP, advanced placement, is a kind of track. But even then, it's just AP, and then English 3, then we have AP for seniors, and then that's literature and composition, and then we have just regular English 4. But sophomore year, there's no AP, and there's no remedial track 1, track 2. I've taught at schools where there's three tracks. I think my high school had five tracks, where there's different sort of ability levels for all these different classes, which I don't like in general. I think that school is school. You just show up to class, and the teacher's job is to teach everybody the material that they need to teach and to set a high standard and, diversification in the classes, so that all whatever it is that you're learning, you should be able to. I was listening to this thing about, I think it's Khan Academy is doing some kind of online school now out of Las Vegas or something. I can't remember. I was listening to a podcast about it, and they were kind of talking about how they just meet kids wherever they are, and the online courses sort of just cater to their ability level, and they can only go to the next level once they advance beyond that level. And I understand that, and I think it is a challenge to have that kind of classroom in a regular run-of-the-mill classroom for all students, but I think it's possible, especially with English. I think, you know, math, you can have kids who are just speeding ahead and want higher level stuff to get ready for college. And I think so it's probably different for every, you know, subject, but with English, I feel like it's if it's going to be possible anywhere, it's in history and English, art, you know, anything that's basically not math and science. Although, you know, I think if we put our minds to it, we can achieve anything. And I think that having equitable practices starting in kindergarten, you know, where we have all kids at the same level and you know, catering to whatever level that they're at with different activities in class is also important. But anyway, my point is that I taught sophomores, there was only one track. And so in my single class, and this is kind of the advantage, right, in that I don't have one class of low-level kids and one class of high-level kids. I have a mixture of all level kids. And in that whole class discussion, of course, you can group kids however you want. You can, and I don't do that. You know, I have seniors, and they can be with their friends. I heard you're not supposed to do that. I mean, I you know, teach in a school where maybe that's possible, but I feel like anywhere it's possible, if you have a good activity, I don't think it matters if they're with their friends or not. I think you want friends to engage with the literature. I think that's a kind of a cool experience. I don't think it matters. I mean, obviously some kids get distracted, I guess, when you put them with their friends, but not if you have a class that's interesting and engaging and keeps them busy and on task and all of that, and high expectation for learning, good classroom culture, all that stuff. So the challenge that I sort of had was, okay, so how we have these really high level kids who are probably already writing at a college level, that's not an exaggeration, their sophomore year, and then kids who are not even at grade level. How do you have a class conversation with both those types of kids? You know, and how do you include everybody where they feel welcome? And I remember, I'm not perfect at this. I would love to see a teacher who does this perfectly, where every single hand is in the air with every question. Although, you know, that's possible too, depending on the conversation and, again, the way that you run your class and whether people feel comfortable sort of chiming in. But I do remember I early in my career had it was actually a swimmer who was my student. And at practice, she was saying, like, this is also early in the year, and I was still establishing the kind of culture and the laid-back style that I have, where it is heavy, you know, very philosophical and intellectual, and we get into really good conversations. But at the beginning of the year, it's, you know, she just said it was felt kind of intimidating, that she was like really scared to say something out loud, because my class moves fast and people chime in, they think and they're writing and then they're sharing what they write. Ultimately, you know, that was something eventually she got more comfortable in the class so she can chime in on the conversations. But that is, you know, I think a big part of what we do is to sort of make it a welcoming place where everybody in the whole group can talk at one time. And I do notice that. So what I'm going to go through in this podcast is just my 10 different sort of approaches, the strategies to leading a whole class discussion. I think the teacher is always part of the mix with these kinds of conversations. And I do feel like sometimes nonfiction lends itself to really good conversations. There are different sort of moments that lend themselves to good conversations. But the general way that I run my class, I feel like I could probably do it on any given day. Of course, you don't do it you don't do anything the same every single day. So of course you don't do whole class discussions, but I feel like it is the traditional sort of thing to do. Whereas the traditional thing to do before was just have a lecture, teach the material, they listen, take notes, read passages of the book, take more notes. Right. Well, now is, okay, so let's have conversations. Let's have kids having conversations with each other, teaching each other the material, having intellectual conversations and answering questions together as a group, where the teacher sort of just guides that sort of process. And so the student-oriented learning, right? This is really what makes our life easy, is when the kids can really run the show, but on a level where we are at. So we're obviously the experts about the book, the essay. We're able to sort of navigate these conversations better than they can. That's why we're the teacher. So that's why I think we always should have a role somewhere in these conversations and learning how to open the conversation up. And there's different how to ask a good question is really at the heart and soul of what it means to be a good teacher. So I think that's I mean, I don't even think I have that listed as a strategy, but that's obviously the really most important thing is to have a good essential question and to have a good question that is your objective for that novel or short story, if it's fiction that you're doing, or that poem, is to have a question that guides students. And so they can kind of think about this really good question that they have to get the bottom of, just like in physics or science or anything else, where there's a question and they have to figure out this complicated way to get to the answer. And so I think that this is something that is important because of the pandemic, but I feel like I saw a trend before the pandemic where less and less kids want to be a part of a whole class conversation. Maybe it's because of social media, where you post something and it's public and kids might have bad experiences with that. I think it's anxiety. I think it's maybe, I mean, for an individual student, there's a million reasons, right? They might come from a house where they have three older siblings and they're talkers and they're loud and they can't really get a word in. It could just be the culture of their house in general. The family just come from a quiet family. I know I was a quiet student. Think about who you were. Were you the one raising your hand in 2 seconds to answer the question as a kid over and over again? Maybe you were. But I think a lot of kids do like to learn in a variety of different ways. Sometimes they like seeing it on a projector. They like seeing it on a board with arrows and circles and different colors. Some kids, you know, I remember I had a student who she just sat in the corner in the back and she took the most incredible notes I've ever seen, reading notes and class notes. She just wrote down everything. It was a lot. And she used them to study. She would always listen to every single word that was going on. You wouldn't think it because she sat in the back and was quiet. And she would always chime in at the end of the conversation, raise her hand, and have this observation that clearly demonstrated that she was taking in everything that everyone was saying and processing it. And so she wasn't that, you know, excellent in the sense that she raised her hand all the time and participated in every single question, but she was definitely participating, right? So kids, just because they're not raising their hand in your class doesn't mean they're not with you. I think that's important to know too. But kids are shy, right? They're kids. Let's not forget they're kids. I have seniors. So I think as they move along in high school, you want to get them to be more open and courageous with voicing their thought. Obviously, there's a million reasons why it's important. Writing is important, but you might be able to argue that speaking is more important in the service economy that we have right now. Having good relationships with people is a crucial part of, I think, any job, whether you're building a building or you're a doctor or, you know, and everything in between. You know, I have interactions with the person who delivers my mail every day. I mean, it's just an important part of problem solving and being open to new ideas and just getting along with people and being a team. You know, we think about relationships with your family, with your significant others. Talking out loud, this is a huge essential part about what we do as teachers. And if you're thinking about it, if you're a scientist and you're kind of this, you know, quiet person who just likes to plug in equations, you might, you know, have to explain those things in regular language to other people and, again, collaborate on, you know, what the implications of those findings are and those discoveries that you made. What does it mean for, you know, products or the environment or whatever it is? And you have to really think critically and creatively, even when you're a scientist. And part of that is communicating your ideas out loud, not just in words, but out loud. You might find yourself in a court case, you know, if you're a scientist, where, you know, something broke or, you know, some accident that you have to testify to something, right? You have to articulate everything that you thought and that you think about to an audience of people. So there's very few jobs, I feel like, where spoken language is just not important. And so writing is obviously the heart and soul of what we do, but speaking and speaking out loud in front of a group, not just in front of two or three people in a kind of a meeting style conversation, but in front of 20, 25 people. And of course, what we're doing is getting them ready for larger groups. I remember when I was the advisor of a literary magazine in my school, we had a poetry festival, and that was part of it. We had probably five or six classes where teachers just brought their kids down, and They read a poem out loud in front of a larger audience. Now, some kids are naturals. They're on stages with the school musical and different things like that, or they're, you know, playing an instrument. So we want to get them ready for those situations where they can perform and talk to a large group. So 25, you know, shouldn't be that bad. So the key thing here that we have to think about is how to get them ready to speak out loud. There is a very, very few people. Right. Think about it. I feel like, you know, I haven't taught in 100 different schools, but I feel like for every teacher, if you think about your own class, I would, you know, make a pretty good bet that there's four or five or six kids probably that when you ask a question, raise their hand immediately. Right. It's like ready to go. They have a lot of energy. Their English is their class. They love reading books. They read the book. They have thought about it. They've taken notes on it. They are ready to contribute to the conversation. I think for a lot of kids, it's a boredom killer. Like they'd rather raise their hand and partake in the conversation than they would just like sort of drift off and be bored. So it's a way of killing time to be sort of excited about the conversation and bounce ideas off people. Some kids thrive in that environment. And then there's a handful of kids, maybe 10 or 15. This is your run-of-the-mill kid who will, you know, ask a question, you know, maybe once or twice through the class period. And then there's kids who just, they don't want to talk. And that, again, I think that's totally fine. They might be paying attention, taking notes. You don't have to have this expectation that every single hand is in the air for every single question. But, you know, that's the objective, right? And that's when you know class is going well. So you ask a question and, you know, 10 different hands shoot up and you're like, all right, so now we're talking, right? Now everybody's got strong feelings about what's going on in this book. I do feel like it's, over the years, that has happened less and less. Maybe it's me. I don't know. There's different things that I've done to try to combat that sort of trend. I think projects are, you know, anytime you can interrupt the regular flow of like interpreting literature with nonfiction, I feel like that, and just open up the conversation to anything and everything, whether it's technology or the environment or politics or the president, where you can just sort of open it up in that way. That's always a good sort of opportunity for that natural flow of you're not even looking for hands in the air because the kids are just responding to each other and talking to each other in a large group of 25 kids or so. That's always amazing because then I can chime in whenever I want and just sort of, again, open up the conversation again with more questions or just have some observations where I'm playing the devil's advocate or trying to, you know, state some other point of view to consider, a counter argument, something like that, just to get people to think about different things. I think that's all things to think about. I think it's important for kids to come out of their shell, get comfortable in speaking to crowds. Everybody's going to have a supervisor at some point, so they're going to have to present their ideas and their, you know, even if you're like a construction manager, right? You need to be confident in what you're saying, your ability to articulate a plan. There's, of course, jobs out there for people who are quiet, but this is obviously a really important part. And just, you know, expressing how you feel and your ideas, that's always a really important part of life. So it is something that we definitely want to think about. How many kids are we reaching? How many hands are we seeing in the air to participate in the conversation? So let's get into this. Just looking over everything that I wanted to say, and I think I touched on everything. One thing before we begin is that one thing I learned pretty early in my career is that having a single kid present. Now, there's, I think, a difference between a whole class conversation and one person presenting, where everybody else is listening to that one presentation. In that case, in all cases, I make sure that I have notes for my entire unit. I print out scaffold notes, like guided notes. You can find these. I have a Teachers Pay Teachers page. I have my online courses where I actually arrange my class by topic. So I have a guiding question for a topic, and then we track that topic through the whole book. So there's always opportunities to basically either work with a partner. I'm going to kind of go through everything. But when you have one kid presenting their findings to the class, I always have everybody taking notes because I have the notes printed out for that whole unit. And so everybody's responsible for finding quotes and writing their interpretation of different passages down in the book. And so those, so that guarantees that everybody in the classroom will be engaged and not just like passively listening or passively tuning out, whatever. Because that's mostly what I found when one person presented. If no one, everybody's got to be expected to do something, especially if those presentations are long or involve PowerPoints, that sort of thing. So I think the obvious thing is to get kids to talk in front of a large group. We're talking about those kids that are not likely to talk or not necessarily willing, even those run-of-the-mill kids that, raise their hand once or twice every class period. How do you get everyone involved? That's a question here. And so basically, I guess there's like two major techniques. The 10 that I have basically revolve around let them work together first, and then the think pair share kind of approach where you, I'm not really, I think it's a little excessive to have kids like think about something, then talk about it, and then, because at some point it's redundant, right? Like I think it's more important to get to a variety of different ideas as quickly as you can. So if you're having them work independently, then work in pairs, then work as a class to go over it, you're going over the same thing three times. That might work for a lot of kids. And that's good to sort of make sure that you know whatever, is important about that passage or whatever it is that you're talking about. But you want to make sure there's variety. And so that's why what I do with topics is good, because I have, let's say, anywhere from 10 to 30 passages on a single topic. And so depending on the groups, I can either assign one person one passage, or I can assign two people one passage. I can assign two people three passages. I can assign six people two or three passages, right? So I can kind of just mix up the numbers however I want. Usually that's what I do to start classes. Look at how many passages I have. Look at how many students I have. Do quick math in my head and think, all right, so this is how we're going to break up this work. And that way, everybody's taking notes on everything, and then they're presenting it however they want. So the other thing that I do as a side note before I get through the 10 is that I have a class participation grade. I go back and forth with this grade at the start of every single year. I ask myself, do I want to have a class participation grade? And my justification, I always basically decide, yes, I do. Because I know I've seen a lot of teachers just basically, I'm going to try it out and not do the class participation grade. Because the way I do my grades is I weight them. So I have 50% for writing, 15% for classwork, 15% for reading notes. So that's just reading the book and taking notes. I don't do quizzes. And then 20% for class participation. You can play around with those percentages. But that when you think about it, everything I just talked about, the fact that I just said that speaking is more important or just as important as writing, but yet I count speaking as 20%, right? And I think the trend even in math now is your grade is the test grade. You're not getting homework grade. You're not getting classwork grade, because that just leads to grade inflation. And it's true. Like, I think colleges are starting to wonder like what kids are actually capable of, because the grades are so inflated by all these extra little assignments. And yeah, you can turn that in late, and yeah, you can make that up, right? And we just keep sort of babying them a little bit. When you think about it, the 50% you could argue should be more like 80 or 90. But the writing, the speaking grade, which is the class participation grade, and this is how I justify keeping that 20% there. Number one, some kids care about their grade, and so it kind of keeps them paying attention, and you have kids that are just motivated by the grade, and that's fine. As long as they're motivated. Some are extrinsic and some are intrinsic. So I think the grade is there for that. The grade is there for rewarding the kid. It's mostly about this. It's mostly about rewarding the kid who can't write that well, but they can speak well, right? They can really articulate. Why wouldn't they get credit or get graded on their interpretation of the book that they speak out loud, and instead of solely focusing on just their ability to write that thought, speaking that thought out loud is again just as important, or maybe more important than writing it down. So there should be a decent percentage of the grade that I think that should go towards the speaking element of language. And so that's the class participation grade. You could argue that class participation is about showing up to class and turning stuff in on time and your general effort and how much you've improved. It's kind of that wiggle room that you have. to get the kid the grade that you sort of think they deserve. But for the most part, I think that's not really as important as this is what you said in my class. I'm giving you a grade on the frequency of your participation, but also the quality of what you say out loud. You can't just talk all the time and not make good points, right? Your grade is just like your grade on an essay. It's about quantity, but it's also about quality. And so that's the class participation grade. So that's one sort of way. And, you know, anytime you have a graded sort of class discussion, I just feel like that gets kind of cutthroat. It definitely works, but it doesn't feel like what I want to do every day, first of all. It doesn't feel authentic. It feels like it's a threat. You know, I'm grading this conversation, you know. Whereas the class participation grade is like, yeah, I'm grading every conversation. Right. So, this is just me thinking out loud. I think there's a lot of different options there. But anyway, let's get into the strategies. I'll try to go through these as quickly as possible. So the first one is that you basically assign pairs or small groups, one or a few, like I just described, one or a few passages. Like, you let them discuss it first. And then you can do the interesting thing about this, right, is that you can have them present their findings to the class. You don't have to do all of them. Like I said, if you have 10 to 30 passages that you want to cover with a single topic, they don't have to go through all 30 of those. You could say to a group, and this is what I often do, is like, pick your favorite topic or favorite passage. So if you assign five groups of five passages, so you have five kids in one group and you give that group five passages, you might say, all right, pick your favorite passage. And that could be part of what you tell them to do. It's like, I want you to pick your favorite one and say why it's your favorite. Why do you think it's the most important passage that you looked at, right? Sometimes you want to go through and make sure you get all of them, but that's one sort of approach if you don't, right? Again, you're giving all this time for the kids to go over the passages, and then you're spending all that time going over the same passages. So it's redundant a little. So that's one way of basically moving a little bit faster. Now, you know, if you're giving, you know, all of the kids the same passage, you know, you do that too. Or all five groups, you have five groups of five kids, and they all talk about the same passage, and then they come back, and as a group, they talk about that one passage. Then you can have this really good conversation, I guess, really an in-depth conversation. But at that point, I would just do a close reading and have the passage onto the document camera and have a whole class discussion where everybody is sort of chiming in. Now, of course, that's one approach, right? You give the passage, close reading. All right, everybody tell me the different things that you found in this passage. And that way, you should have a lot of hands in the air. That's not something where you assign, you know, sort of assign people a passage, which would require them to speak out loud. Now, I've seen cold call. Cold call is okay. Again, doesn't feel authentic to me. It feels a little bit like punishment, a little bit of like a gotcha. It keeps people attentive, right? Because if you might be called on, then you got to pay attention all of the time just because you might be called on. But again, I don't work under the premise of threats. I want to work on the premise of we all have something that we want to say, and sometimes we're going to be expected to say it, and I'll give you time, and I'm not going to sort of do a gotcha moment because you were having a hard day and hungry and tired and just in la la land for a little bit, right? Kids are not perfect. They're not going to be paying attention 100% of the time. Although, you know, again, I think if you have the right culture, they will be. If you make it feel like they want to participate in the conversation rather than I'm going to get you by, you know, making this random person talk, right? And the strategy there is, you know, don't do that all the time, do it once in a while, but I just don't like cold calling every once in a while, but it always kind of feels that way. So, all right, that's the first thing. That's the first strategy. Have them discuss it, and then you share your findings with the class. The second strategy is do it independently. So basically, you have each kid work by themselves. It's quiet time. It's seat work, if you want to use that term. That's the term that we use, is seat work. And then after 5 or 10 minutes, they get to sort of go through however many passages you and again, these don't have to be the same passage. Each kid could have a different passage. You know, you could divide it up however you want. But then basically, you know, you come back to the entire class and you go through in this case, you'd have to go very, very quickly, right? You're like, I want a very quick interpretation. Sometimes PowerPoints work for that. I'll get to that. Well, that's actually my next one. So my next one is, that's number three, is basically create a PowerPoint slide in a class participation. So what I'll do for that is I'll create 25 different slides. Each kid has one. Again, you have six slides and there's five students working on the one slide. You know, you play with the numbers however you want. You have one slide presentation that you can just work your way through. So you get to 5, you get to 10, you get to 20 slides, however many slides, and the kids are responsible for creating that slides. They have something to talk about. They're comfortable because they can just read what's on the slide. But I think, you know, even going over what makes a good PowerPoint presentation, because again, talking about real world skills here, you don't want to talk to a group of people by just reading a slide. That's boring. You know, we've all been in presentations where the person reads the PowerPoint and it's just annoying. It's just ridiculous, right? You're just like, I could have just read this. Why is this? Why are you here? I could have just, this could have been an email. I'll read the PowerPoint and call it a day, right? So you want to have it your students be engaging speakers where they're connecting with their audience and they just write a few things down. Sometimes I'll say that. So just put the quote on the PowerPoint. So that way the quote's there and they can read the quote. Everybody can see the quote and take notes on the quote, but then they can take notes on what the person is saying. So they've already thought about what they're going to say about the quote, and then it's just the quote on the slide. So that's the third sort of strategy, is to have them do that PowerPoint. The fourth strategy is a Google drawing. So, I cover this, all of these, in my online course. And you can actually see student work and how I'd actually do it in my class and what it looks like and the different directions I have for different assignments. But with a Google drawing, you can make it bigger, and then every student in the class can work in a single document. And in that document, I think a Padlet is sort of the same idea, or what was the other one? The Jamboard, I think, was something similar. But I like Google Drawings. It's free. It's simple. You can make it bigger. And then so what I can do, and for me, seeing the presentation is key. So I used to do stuff on the board. I used to do posters, but the whole class can't see a poster. The whole class can't look at the board and always understand what somebody wrote, right? So for me, a Google Drawing is great because you can zoom in on that. It's sort of similar to a Prezi, but just not as fancy, I guess, where you zoom in on what different people said. And all I say is, hey, who wrote this? Right? And it could be a phrase, it could be a topic, it could be a question. This is a sort of a graphic organizer the entire class created on this one question and this one short story or poem or whatever it is. And so we just sort of zoom in on the different parts. And that way it is kind of like cold calling, but they're ready to present what they said because they wrote it, right? So you're not necessarily calling people out randomly. You're just like, hey, this looks really cool and interesting. Who wrote that? Can you share me a little bit of what you were thinking with that, right? So that's number four. Number five is to ask students to write a small argument or paragraph on an index card. So these are all obviously related to visuals and kind of that think, pair, share idea where they're working, maybe in a group, maybe independently, but they just write down the argument on this little piece of paper. And then what I'll do is put it under the document camera so that it projects again, because you can't read what's on an index card. So this way with index cards, they're great because I can just shuffle through the index cards and pick ones that I think are good, that I think that make really good points. And then that way they're kind of proud that they got selected to, you know, oh, this is a really good argument. Who wrote this one? Can you talk a little bit more about this? So that way it's like I'm rewarding them. So rather than like a threat of I'm going to pick on you and you better have something good, this way it's like, hey, you did something, you said something great, I want to hear more about that. And then and if you have the student's name on there, you can pick kids who are not those five stellar students who raised their hand in 2 seconds, right? You can get all the other kids who are not normally engaged in the conversation and call them out. So it's kind of forced because you're calling them and saying, can you share this? But it's also, again, hey, I really like this, and it's positive reinforcement. And so they're really excited that they can share something on the index card because they made a good argument. So that's easy. And that's, yeah, when you put it under the document camera and you project it on the screen, everybody can read it. They can take notes. Again, everybody's taking notes. So it's not just like one kid presenting one thing. Everybody's taking notes on what's on the index card. They're seeing model writing, right? So you look at the argument, if it's a thesis statement, or you could say, hey, interpret one quote, incorporate the quote into your sentence, whatever it is that you're practicing with writing, whatever they need to work on, you're just practicing that through your class and then allowing people to present that way. Number six is to create an audio recording. And we got into this with the pandemic and made me realize some kids really just like doing what I'm doing right now, which is just recording an audio. They sort of have an audience. I've seen different strategies online where students can do a public discussion and do audio recordings that way, where they have these sort of virtual conversations and it's on their own time. So they can just kind of listen to somebody's audio and then have an audio recording that they submit. So it's not this live Zoom chat thing we did during the pandemic, but it's this thing that kind of unfolds. Sometimes I do it with privately where it's just an assignment and it's not a discussion and they just submit it to me. And then I listen to them answer a question or talk about a particular passage. There's also video essays. That's another interesting thing about presenting, like in, you know, to add to, again, you're talking about like a whole class discussion. This is like, is that really a whole class discussion? It is, it is, right? Like people are like the whole class discussion is everyone's saying something. And so an audio recording is, it's people saying something. And I know that's sort of hard to wrap our head around with technology, but it is real. You know, they are saying something. Other people, again, may, depending on whether or not you want to make it anonymous, they are they're listening or they're not listening. The teacher is always listening. So there is an audience there. So that's, you know, but that's something to think about. Number seven is to write a short response on the board. So I sort of mentioned how that can be hard, but if you have a whiteboard, you have good ink that people can see. When I do this, and this is so very similar to Google drawing, right? But it's on the board. So you have a graphic organizer with the topic that you're going to cover in the middle of the board, and then I just tell my kids, hey, go up there and just write down quotes, write down phrases, topics, connect them to each other. So if somebody writes something that you think is related to what you're talking about or thinking or your interpretation of a quote, you can do a line, an arrow, you know, squiggly something, whatever. They can get creative and just write all these different things down on the board. And then, again, same thing with the Google drawing. I basically say, hey, who wrote that? And they have to share what they wrote because they wrote it on the board, but it's quick. In those cases, I just go through so many kids, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 kids, because I'm just like, who wrote that? All right, quick. Who wrote that? Quick. Right? And so it's a very quick way of including everyone in on this conversation, where you're not just sitting around a circle having a conversation. They're just chiming in from wherever they're sitting in their seat. So I think I mentioned this already. So number eight is basically the close reading. So you have, like I just did this with my class, so this is a good example. So in Hamlet we did, let's see if I can name everybody, Claudius talking to Hamlet. Then we have Laertes talking to Ophelia. We have Polonius talking to Laertes. And then I feel like I'm missing one. We have King Hamlet the Ghost talking to Hamlet. I feel like I'm missing one. There's four total, but that's not included. There's five. And it's Laertes and Ophelia, the older brother. I don't know if he's older brother, but sounds like he is. The brother-sister relationship. So the topic is family. We got all these different sort of relationships and families, even Claudius's family. The interesting thing is that Gertrude's not in there, but we do look at when Gertrude and Hamlet have their sort of confrontation after he stages the play. So anyway, so I had those, I printed out those passages, one copy of each passage, gave it to groups of three or four. Those three or four students had to mark up each of those passages, regular piece of paper, with their interpretations of the personification, the parallel structure, repetition, and kind of the literary techniques that they had to interpret to basically paraphrase and interpret what they were saying and analyze the passage. And then they presented those notes to the rest of the class. The class had a scaffolded notes, so they had, you know, whatever, page 27, had a space, a blank space on number 27. So as the group presented their close reading of the passage, everybody else in the class could just write down different notes from that passage and different literary techniques and ideas, whatever they want to write down with their notes. It's all right there. So that's another way, is by having them think first with a close reading of a passage. All right, so number nine, basically, they write down with the strategies that they have to write down their favorite quote from a passage on a sheet of paper. So this is not an index card; it's just a sheet of paper. And it's big. You can have Sharpies, right, where it's really clear writing. You can have them write, you know, right? So it's, I mean, an index card you can kind of like zoom in on. So this is very similar to the index card one. But if you want to do just the quote from the passage, that's it. Hey, write your favorite quote down and be ready to talk about it a little bit. That's quick. Again, it's an easy way of including everybody on the conversation. You can look at the sheets of paper, read the quote out loud, and then people take notes on it. So that's kind of redundant. I should probably rethink that one because it's pretty similar to the index card one. I don't know why. Index card's a little more fun. All right, so number 10 is the teacher asked students to post their formal. So I asked students basically to post their formal responses online, and then there's two things I can do that with this. So you can have a discussion where everybody reads each other's responses, and they're just there for everybody to see, and their names are on it. And when I do that, I just say, hey, listen, you know, this is going to be posted. Everybody's going to be able to read what you're saying. Just be aware of that. And they're usually fine with that. And then there's also the anonymous one. And so in that case, I take their assignment that they submit to me privately, I copy and paste it into a document, and put it into a Word document so that you can't see who wrote the response, but you can just kind of quickly go through all of the you don't have to do all of them, but you could quickly read the responses, whether it's answering a question or interpreting a quote, all the things that we were just basically talking about. It's a more formal way, right? When they're typing, it's a little more formal than just, say, writing a word on a board or a little quote on an index paper, right? So you have a sort of formal interpretation or a thesis statement, a body, you know, topic sentence, whatever you want to call it, with some, you know, quote, you know, interpretation of a quote that you would see in a body. Sometimes I'll do full body paragraphs and I'll pick the best body. So if that's what we're working on, it's like, all right, so let's look at a body paragraph and look at how the arguments move through this body paragraph. And so that works as model work as well too, so that they can basically, you don't have to read all of them, right? Just read a couple of them. That's the most formal of all of these sort of techniques to get kids to talk out loud and basically with these very short presentations have a class conversation where you're giving them the opportunity to sometimes very, very quickly in a couple of minutes. And sometimes it's honestly, sometimes, you know, when I do one pagers, for instance, and this is not the result of that is not a class conversation, but with one pagers, I'll give them two full class periods to complete a one pager because they have to gather the quotes, they have to interpret the quotes, and then they have to select what quotes are their favorite quotes from that passage or from that topic. Again, sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's 30. So they pick out their, say, favorite five or six. I'll have directions with that. Pick out your favorite five quotes and create a fun one-pager creative graphic, basically, with images and symbols that they draw on the one-pager. And you could also have them present that. You know, sometimes I hang stuff in the hallway. So, yeah, these aren't all class discussion traditional, but, you know, it's all basically the same ideas. You give them time to do something, and then But you know, the one that I didn't include is the regular, the run-of-the-mill thing I do, and maybe I'll replace, I'll kind of revise in my blog, because I basically just read my blogs, is to do a run-of-the-mill read-aloud. So let me actually just type this in right here. It's a read-aloud. So what in a regular run-of-the-mill class, I will take those, say, let's say there's 15 passages that relate to a topic. I read the passage. I basically just give them the guy, here's the topic. I introduce the topic. I usually talk about the modern relevance of the topic. Right now we're talking about madness in Hamlet. And then the one topic we just covered earlier in the week was the ghost in Hamlet. So we talk about ghosts and, like, you know, what movies and shows do people still believe in ghosts? Like it's a relevant topic. What does it mean on a literary level to, like, grieve over someone and be haunted by the memory of them, right? Is it just like that kind of expression of not being able to get over somebody? Is that really what a ghost is? You know, all these different sort of things to think about with ghosts. I'll sort of introduce that topic, have a guiding question, and then read. I'll have 15 passages. We read each of those passages. So we read one passage out loud. And then I ask a question. As we're reading it, I will think of a question in my head. And then at the end of the reading, I'll ask that question. The class will raise their hand, talk about it, and then we move to the next one. So sometimes two or three students, you know, again, depending on how good the question is, sometimes 10 people will respond, sometimes one person will respond. It's like, all right, so let's go to the next passage. You read that passage. And as you read the passages related to the topic of the ghost, hopefully as you move along, all of your students are going to have something that they think about that topic. So your first few kids that raise their hand right away and they're really quick thinkers, you knock them out. That's usually what happens in my class. I knock them out right away, right? I ask the first question about the first few passages. Those A students, they're right there for you. And then as you stay on that topic and move along through the book, then that's when I see more and more hands from the rest of the class go up as the conversation goes. And it's sometimes it's just as simple as, hey, I want to hear from somebody else, right? I want to hear, I don't want to, if you said something, you're done. I want to hear from everybody in this conversation, right? Sometimes you have to do that because people will tune out and go on their phones and be distracted, right? So that's the regular run-of-the-mill thing I do. So we'll replace the piece of paper and the index card thing with just a regular read-aloud, teacher-led class conversation. And that's your sort of traditional run-of-the-mill way that I feel like most teachers roll in, and that's what they do, right? They read a passage out loud, and that way, you know, it kind of benefits the kids who have not read the novel. You know, they haven't read the book. They read this online summary. You know, this, let's just say it. Those kids are out there. They're always going to be out there. Don't get frustrated by it because you're rereading. I reread huge portions of the text that I teach out loud in class because that's how I do it. And think about it. I'm picking the most important passages from the novel. They're hearing about the plot all the time. So they're still, you know, learning to be literate and learning how to interpret literature and think good thoughts, even if they're not doing their homework. Of course, if they are doing the homework, you know their observations are going to be really on point, really high quality observations. You know their essays are going to be better, right? So this style of running class, and I think it applies to all of these, that's, you know, because the kids who have not read, they're not going to participate in the class conversations. But if you're reading the book out loud constantly, then all of a sudden it's like, all right, well, maybe I read it quickly, or maybe I, you know, haven't read it all, but I can still be a part of this conversation. And that's important because maybe for the next book, they will read it, right? Because they're excited to be a part of the conversation and feel like they can participate in it. And that's how you connect with those kids who might not otherwise want to be a part of it. All right, that was a long one. How long was that one? Oh man, 47 minutes. Yeah, so that's, I mean, I covered this topic in my online course, and in that part of my online course, I really go through and show you what all of this looks like and show you the possibilities of all the different specifics of what I just went over. And the visual, I think, really helps. So that's kind of what we did today, is talking about whole class discussion strategies. If you like listening to the podcast, please give me a review so that I can get out word and reach more teachers. Thank you for listening.